On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday morning, and it's Maryland morning. What's your identity project? The thing that puts a skip in your step when you wake up every day. Maybe it's the instrument you play or the poems you're writing. Well, for a lot of kids living in Baltimore's most impoverished neighborhoods, their identity project can be their ticket out of economic hardship. Stephanie DeLuca spent 10 years studying kids in Baltimore's public housing and how some are able to break the cycle of poverty. Her new book is Coming of Age in the Other America. Then, the Everyman Theater is presenting not one, but two American classics. Directors Vincent Lancisi and Derek Goldman on A Streetcar and A Salesman. Plus, the Maryland Poetry Out Loud champ is in the studio, sharing the verse that propelled her into the national finals. Her story and a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1 WYPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This has been a week in which Baltimore has taken a hard look back and what some hope will be a big leap forward. All over town, conversations and events have been held to mark the one-year anniversary of the violence and uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray last April. With the election of Senator Catherine Pugh and a host of new candidates to be the Democratic nominees for mayor and city council, many people see an opportunity to break with the past policies that seeded the racial and economic inequality that led to the massive display of frustration, anger, and despair on the streets of our city. So this morning, we continue our series of conversations about inequality with a researcher from Johns Hopkins University who spent 10 years studying 150 young people from some of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods. Dr. Stephanie DeLuca and two colleagues have written an eye-opening book about the ways in which poverty is caused and sustained and the ways in which it can be ameliorated. It's called Coming of Age in the Other America. Stephanie, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning. Good to see you.
So this is the first time, you tell us in this book, that anybody has done a study of this length, it sounds like, and it also ends up being an intergenerational study. You studied not only these kids from when they were kind of little to when they became late teens, early 20s, but you got to know a lot about their parents, too. You found out a lot of stuff about these folks.
We did. And, you know, I have to say that I'm working in the legacy of my colleague Carl Alexander and Doris Entwistle, who had done the quarter-century-long study of the first graders in Baltimore, who were about a decade older than the young people that we profiled here. And what we did a bit differently is we talked to fewer families and children and sort of got into their homes a bit more and, you know, spent more time in their communities and tracked over time, the mechanisms, the processes underneath the inequality that I think Carl and Doris so soberly profiled.
It's so easy to despair when you see some of the data. I mean, you hear things, and we heard a bunch of this data, particularly during the mayoral campaign and before, certainly, and since the riots last year and the uprising. You know, a kid born in Harlem Park can expect to live 20 years less than the kid born in Roland Park. It is so easy to think these are intractable problems and that there's just nothing that's going to change it. But your book actually suggests something different.
Right. So I'll admit that we sat down to work on this book, which was born out of a project studying the Moving to Opportunity experiment, which gave families in five cities, including Baltimore, a chance to leave the high-rise projects that we then ended up tearing down. And so
The idea from that was to move them from these projects to areas that had less crime,
that
less
were
poverty.
Lower poverty, right. And while that's certainly featured prominently in the book, I think what struck us while we were in the field, during our meetings, during the writing, was this incredible resilience, this brightness, this deep humanity, this grit that these young people displayed. And it was so hard to ignore that. It was so hard to figure out, out how do you write a book and just get out of the way of these kids' amazing stories. And what I think we realized is that this is where the potential lies. It's sitting right in front of us. It's right there. You know, these young people have moved mountains that many of us will never come near. And yet, at the brink of adulthood, you know, even our most promising young people struggle mightily in the face of institutions that underserve them.
Just a couple of days ago on the show, we had two entrepreneurs who have moved here recently from Oakland, California, women named Aisha Pugh and B. Cole. And they talked about how it's so often the case that people use these micro stories to tell a macro story that is often incorrect. That the micro story of, you know, the kid pouncing on the police cruiser or, you know, cutting the fire hose during the uprising does not tell the story of the African-American community. In overall, what do your, because this book is chock full of micro stories. You know, you get to know these young people by name, you know, first name at least, and you hear this very interesting and diverse web of different kinds of experiences. What do you think the macro story is that gets told from all these micro stories in this book?
Well, it's interesting that you bring it up that way. So we tell lots of micro stories, right? And as sociologists, we had a systematic approach to collecting them. And I think the strength in that approach, it allows us to, you know, to say what's going on broadly for a group of young people who share disadvantages. Managed origins, not let's take a look at what's happening outside on the corner. Let's take a look at kids who are, you know, only delinquent kids, only high school dropouts, only those who were throwing things, you know, a week ago last year at police cars. So when you, I think what happens is when we focus only on the most aggravating, threatening images, you know, of inner city life, it leads people who have spent no time in these communities to believe that that extreme is the norm, that that exception is the norm. And in fact, what we uncover in some ways is, you know, is not surprising at all to many of the people who live in these communities, which is that these young adults are adhering, you know, strongly to mainstream values and goals about education and work. It only comes as a surprise, I think, to, you know, the many middle-class neighbors who never set foot in these communities, right? This idea that we are separated by geography and segregation has serious consequences for, you know, how we view their potential. And I think most people don't go beyond, you know, television images and quick, you know, media images to say, I wonder what it's really like there.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the co-author, along with Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden, of Coming of Age in the Other America. It's interesting how this notion that folks in the middle class who have no interaction with people in economically impoverished neighborhoods, it seems like it's becoming hip now to start paying attention and to understand. I know David Brooks, of all people, wrote about this very thing just a couple of days ago. One of the myths that you shatter is, and you've just alluded to it, is that most kids are not, in fact, drawn to the life of the street. They're not drawn to be drug dealers so that they can make more money if they were working at McDonald's for minimum wage. That's the exception, not the rule, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, David Brooks was writing about, the, you know, Baltimore and youth, you know, about a year ago as well, and really focused on the norms in these communities that were missing, saying, you know, will these young people, you know, are they bondage to their desires, or they can they exercise self-control? And I think, you know, implicating norms and values. And I think, you know, if anything, we found that that's not the problem, right? Because, you know, over 80% of the young people in our study were working or in school by the time the study ended, right? It was the few who had turned to the street, you know, and if anything, it was, you know, the street and working on the corner was the last thing, you know, that a young man or woman wanted to end up doing, right? And by, you know, the early 2000s, you know, young people in Baltimore were scorning that kind of a lifestyle in favor of becoming certified nursing assistants, bus drivers, police officers, chefs, you know, forensic scientists, the kinds of things that we know kids across America are also interested in becoming.
Tell us what an identity project is.
So the Identity Project was the surprise of our study. We went into the study, you know, focused on families and neighborhoods and schools, and you know, and how do these social contexts matter for young adults? And what came back strongly to us from these young people was what they were already bringing to the table, which were, you know, these vital, sometimes private, sometimes public activities that ranged from Dana Jenkins, you know, 10 years old in her bedroom using her dad's old VCR, taping what she called Dana's TV show, where she would just sit down and talk about boys or the new poetry she had written, and then do this over and over again over middle school. And her mom, she and her mom can look back now and they sort of laugh and say, remember when? You know, something private like that, you know, or something that's, you know, more structured, like Cody had become involved in the Police Explorers, organization. And so he proudly wore a badge to say, you know, this is what I'm about. And we do these training scenarios. And, you know, this for Cody, this kind of identity project tied him into a structured organization that had potential connections to a job later on. He was also involved in the junior ROTC there. For a number of other young men, employment was the identity project. That badge, the security guard uniform were really strong signals to the rest of the community about what they were doing. And so sometimes these were private escapes, like Vicky building pigeon coops in the backyard, you know, or Dana's TV show. And sometimes they were much more tied to institutions, you know, like some of the career academies at school or some of these community groups. And we found that the latter, these structured, more structured institutionally based identity projects were much more predictive of staying on track by the time our study ended.
And the thing is, you have an identity project. I have an identity project. Anybody who has, I mean, for you, it's your work. For me, it's, you know, I'm a professional musician. I mean, all that. Everybody who's successful has one, including these kids in these neighborhoods. And the ones that have them, they're the ones that have been able to break out and stop the cycle of intergenerational poverty.
At least as far as we could see, they came to this brink of adulthood ready to launch. You know, the ones who had had these identity projects were much more likely to be pursuing work and career, work in school. But as we also note in the book, you know, the grit that they displayed that was inspired by these identity projects, it's not enough alone, right? That narrative is limited to say it's just about grit. I mean, we really have to meet them halfway so that they can, you know, take this incredible potential and roll with it.
You talk about getting them to the table, but we got to have policies that help us, you know, get them to to finish the race. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating read, and I really appreciate your coming by.
Yeah,
thanks
so much.
Thank
you for having me.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca, an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the co-author, along with Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden, of Coming of Age in the Other America. We've got a link to more information about the book, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, the Great American Rep at the Everyman Theater will visit with the directors of A Streetcar Named Desire and Death of a Salesman. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Nathan?
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I bet that some of you can name that play from just those two words. A Streetcar Named Desire is one of the most iconic works in American theater, immortalized in countless stage productions and the famous 1951 movie starring Marlon Brando. The Everyman Theater in Baltimore has chosen to finish their 25th anniversary season with a production of this enduring masterpiece. But as the great philosopher and TV mystic Ron Popeil used to say, but wait, there's more. Everyman has paired Tennessee Williams' iconic classic with another work that looms equally large in the panoply of American thespian achievement, Arthur Miller's poignant and powerful drama, Death of a Salesman. Both plays are currently in repertory at Everyman, performed by the same cast, a cast that sometimes performs both plays on the same day. So what does Stanley Kowalski and Willie Lomax have in common? What bonds do Streetcar and Salesman share? Let's ask the two stage directors who share the bond fond of having worked together at the Everyman Theater on several occasions. Vincent Lancisi joins me in the studio. He's the founder and artistic director of the Everyman Theater in Baltimore and the director of their current production of Death of a Salesman. Derek Goldman joins us on the phone from Washington. He's the artistic director of the Davis Performing Arts Center and a professor of theater at Georgetown University. He has directed Everyman's current production of A Streetcar Named Desire. Good morning and welcome to you guys. Good to talk to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Tom. Nice to be here.
So, Vinny, let me start with you. I understand this is the first time that these two iconic classics have been paired together. What made you take that leap?
You know, it's funny. We were looking for sort of extraordinary projects to do to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Everyman. And when I was sort of ruminating about throwing our theater its birthday party all season long, I thought, what do you want to do that's outside of the box, that's bigger than life, that what do you really want to celebrate? What are some of the things that Everyman does really well? And a lot of people love the way we treat modern classics, the way we value sort of the great writers and great stories. And I thought, you know, how can we as a resident company really do something special with incredible plays and do a special rep? And I was thinking rep modern comedies, and I started thinking one of the most famous modern classics, not comedies, but modern classics. And those two, Death of a Salesman and Streetcar Named Desire, are always number one and two on the list.
They'd be on everybody's list.
Yeah. And then I started looking up when was the last time they were in Baltimore. And, you know, the original tour, right, 1950 or 1948, I think it was, came through Ford's Theater across the street from where Everyman is, a Streetcar. That's the last time Streetcar was done in Baltimore.
Wow. So it's been more than 50
And Center
years.
Stage, yeah. 1972, did Salesman. So yeah. That's, you know, 50 years ago. So
are there actual commonalities between the two plays, and does that matter?
You know, there are a lot more than I realized when I selected the two plays. When we started digging into, you know, comparing them. Yeah, there are. I mean, you know, the two iconic characters, well, there's more than two, but from each play, Willie Loman arrives in the play with his suitcase, his valise of, you know, the clothing that he sells and his suitcase, laden down with the burden of the world. And Blanche DuBois enters New Orleans visiting her sister with all her belongings in her suitcase. And these two characters sort of fighting with illusion and reality and what they think life owes them for all the hard work that they've endured, that loss of the American dream sort of permeates both plays and trickles down to all of the rest of the characters involved in each play.
And thematically, they definitely are connected. I need to correct myself. I think I called him Willie Lomax. I meant to say Willie Loman.
We were with you.
There you go. You know what I was talking about. And Derek Goldman, how about these two authors, these two playwrights, Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller? Are there commonalities between them? They seem to be on completely opposite sides of the spectrum artistically.
Yeah, on the surface, I think that's true. We think of them very differently in terms of their biographies and what their work represents. But it's interesting that they were fans and admirers of each other. In fact, Miller pens what is the introduction to the New Directions version of Streetcar Named Desire and talks about his intense admiration and even the kind of transformative experience he has watching the Kazan's production of Streetcar in terms of the poetic landscape of it, the poetic intensity of it. And so I think one of the richnesses of having and working on the two plays side by side, they are more than the sum of their parts. I think in rep we see real differences in terms of a stripped down, spare world of Brooklyn and the world of Willie Loman's mind and the lushness and musicality of New Orleans and the sensuousness of that. But at core, in both plays, the concerns of both playwrights, I think, around the promise of the American dream, the things in both plays that feel so near you could reach out and touch, the sense of possibility, of potential, of beauty, of life gone right, and the way that luck, chance, a bad turn, a moment of human weakness, sexuality can you know, the sort of can turn everything into, in the case of both plays, a sort of darker spiral. So I think that one of the experiences for me in working on both of them was reappreciating how their greatness, the greatness of each playwright, are aligned with each other and in dialogue with each other.
It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. On the phone with us from Washington, Derek Goldman. He's the director of A Streetcar Named Desire, currently at the Everyman Theater. The founder and artistic director of the Everyman, Vincent Lancisi, joins me in the studio. He's directed their production of Death of a Salesman. So, Vinny, I wonder if we learn anything new then, it sounds like we do, about each play when they are juxtaposed like this. Curators at museums put particular paintings and pieces of you know, sculpture next to each other. And folks in my business, when we do a record, we're very careful about the order of the songs on the CD, although the whole downloading thing one at a time sort of blows that up. But we think about it at least. What have you learned about each play because you're dealing with them in toto together?
That's a great question. You know, it becomes immediately apparent. You're not in the theater for 5 minutes before you realize why either playwright is the genius that they are and what they've made possible. I mean, they were really ahead of their time when they were writing. And today, when you read it, it's as if they wrote these plays today. I mean, these issues are very prescient. We recognize these people. We all have relatives or friends or even ourselves have faced retirement in the face without the appropriate savings that's needed to sort of, you know, wonder what the future is going to bring, even though we worked hard all our lives to get there.
Yeah, I was at Salesman last night. It did not seem one bit dated.
It's no really way. I mean, you know, yeah. We show these to our high school matinee kids, Baltimore City school students, and they are in it, fighting with Willie every step of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, and the same thing with Streetcar. You know, when you meet Stanley Kowalski, who's this hardworking average Joe who, you know, is just trying to do the right thing and get through his day and have a little fun at the same time as all of that hard work. Well, he sees through a lot of hypocrisy in life. And what turns out, what looks to be this sort of rough-hewn brute at the top of the play turns out to be the wisest, somehow smart character. Also, you look at, from Williams, at least experiencing Streetcar, it's hot, it's sexy, it's smart, it's funny, it's rich, and
sure.
He's got the heat of New Orleans all through that play, and it's the new world and everything that it was supposed to be, good and bad.
Sure. And Derek, I'm just really intrigued to hear you say, to talk about working on these two plays. I mean, you were directing Streetcar, Vinny was directing Death of a Salesman, but did in either of your rehearsal processes, well, in your rehearsal process, Derek, did it include trying to overtly demonstrate the commonalities between the two themes? Were you part of the rehearsal process for Death of a Salesman as well as the one you're doing?
Yeah, it didn't include trying overtly to, you know, to shoehorn anything differently in than I think that we would have been doing if we had just been focused on Streetcar. But I think by the very virtue of the fact that the creative teams and particularly the actors were moving between both processes and that both plays were sort of in the DNA and the bloodstream of the building for a period of 10 weeks as we rehearsed them and longer in pre-production, I think the resonances, even among the echoes, moments that are sort of like, you know, hit me in the stomach, you know, hit me hard, you know, sort of moments that rippled outwards, I think we all were very aware that we were entwined in an experience in which these two great plays were in dialogue and that we were shaping an experience for an audience that we hoped would experience them side by side and in relationship to each other. So it wasn't a conscious process. Our production of Streetcar, I don't think, has anything that we sort of that is different specifically because we were trying to pay homage to Salesman or to force that in there. But I think there are all kinds of places where the fact that we were, you know, that Biff and Happy from Salesman were coming into my rehearsals as Stanley and Mitch for Streetcar, they were carrying it in their bones, some of those echoes.
You know, Tom, you asked why I selected these two plays, and a big part of it, too, is that we like to think of the actors at Everyman as master transformers, that they transform on a regular basis into different characters. And we thought, how can we take our resident company and say, okay, here are two different plays, completely different worlds, and let our audiences get the extra added layer of watching each actor play perhaps a really large role of a certain character type in one play and maybe a smaller supporting role of a completely different character. I mean, I've heard audience members like sort of guffaw with discovery that, you know, somebody that they saw in a smaller role in one play was actually a well-known actor from our company.
And that's at the fundament of what a resident company is. Every man is a resident company. You have this core of actors. You don't job in different people for each show. You basically have the same core of actors that has to transform itself every time. And this one, there are days when they do both plays on the same day.
20 days.
That's incredible. I mean, because one of them, you know, the Salesman runs 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Right.
And Streetcar is more than 3 hours. You know, right. So for audiences, one of the first things that struck me about this, if you choose one of those Saturdays to go and see a matinee in an evening of both, it's kind of like binge watching House of Cards.
That's right. I mean,
it's the same thing. I mean, Derek, in terms of the technique that these actors have to employ in order to get through a grueling day like that. Do you practice that? Do you rehearse it? I mean, these are professionals. These are obviously people who can do a lot of different things. But it's one thing to do a performance of Streetcar, you know, on a day, but it's a whole other thing to do a performance of Streetcar and Death of a Salesman.
Yeah, I have so much awe and admiration for what I mean, you know, I've always felt that for actors as good as the actors in the Everyman company, but the bar was raised on this, and they've been amazing. But what I think is also true is that the richness of these plays and the sense of detail and these roles are such catnip to actors that there is a kind of adrenaline of truth that they're not exhausted by it because there's a sort of sense that they're at the they're at the top of their game, the top of their craft, challenged by this writing. And one of the most gratifying things to hear, actually, from people who've experienced both productions, is how quickly they seem to move. And of course, some of that is something we were conscious of in trying to find the drive or the engine of them. But people, I don't think, are feeling like they're, you know, sitting through a heavy, exhausting, tragic day. I think there's a sort of life force, a musicality, an energy through the day that's actually quite celebratory in its own way. These plays have real, you know, they grab you by the throat. They have real attack. So
yeah,
I think
I hear the opposite. I hear people getting to the end of the play saying, "I didn't want to leave," especially in Salesman, but really in both that those worlds are so sort of fulfilling and rich and. You, when it's over, you don't quite know what to do with yourself.
And you know, in this world of Twitter and 140 characters, you know, you're not shying away. These are substantial works.
That's right.
You know, around 3 hours of real, you know, brilliant writing. I mean, last night, first act of Salesman. You know, when Linda Lohman, Willie's wife, says, "Attention must be paid."
Yeah.
You really, it's kind of like To Be or Not to Be. I mean, these have become iconic moments in the theater, and you hear it, and you think, my Lord, we are in the presence of genius.
That's right. I mean, we've been walking around like having religious experiences in the rehearsal halls at Everyman, because you do feel like you're in that kind of presence. I mean, this isn't good writing. This is great writing. And it requires Herculean actors to totally transform. I mean, you can't just half-heartedly play Blanche DuBois.
Yeah.
You
right.
have to enter the world of crazy and make sense of it for our audiences.
Yeah.
It's an incredible journey.
Yeah. And Derek, as a playwright and collaborator on many productions that you put together in DC and elsewhere, you do a lot of these things, you know, as a group. You have, you know, people, you start with an idea, you don't even start with a script, and you know, you create these things. What do you think contemporary playwrights learn about contemporary theater from these two geniuses in these two terrific plays?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing to read them and even to experience them as an audience member. It's another thing to work on them and be working moment to moment and detail to detail and realize, and I certainly had this experience with Streetcar, how every single detail, how the clothes come off in a scene and a new outfit gets put on, yeah. All of the props, the fights, the intricacy of it, all that happens in those two rooms, basically, in that small apartment, how perfectly constructed by a young Tennessee Williams writing that play.
And we're going to have to call it a day there, but I really do appreciate the work that both of you guys are doing. Thanks for coming by. Appreciate it. Vincent Lancisi is the founder and artistic director of the Everyman Theater. He's also the director of their current production of Death of a Salesman. Derek Goldman, the artistic director of the Davis Performing Arts Center, and professor of theater at Georgetown University. He has directed Streetcar Named Desire. Got to go see him, folks. Check out the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later, Charisse Achimpom is this year's winner of the Poetry Out Loud competition in Maryland. She's headed to the National Poetry Out Loud competition on Monday. She stops by Maryland Morning this morning. But first, here's Gil Sandler with this week's Baltimore story.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we spent part of the first part of the show talking about great writing. Writers like Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams knew the power of the written word. And my next guest is a young woman who discovered that power and the joy of writing at a very early age. Charisse Achimpong is a 17-year-old senior at Newtown High School in Owings Mills. She's been writing poetry and short stories since she first learned how to wield a pen. Last month, she placed first in the 2016 Maryland Poetry Out Loud competition. That's a poetry reading and writing contest sponsored by the Maryland State Arts Council, the Poetry Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. More than 9,000 students from across the state vied for the $200 prize and the chance to compete in the national finals in Washington on Monday. Charisse Achimpong joins me in the studio. Congratulations and welcome to the show. It's great to meet you.
It's great to meet you, too. Great to be here.
So how does this work, a Poetry Out Loud competition? 9,000 people? That's a lot of rounds.
It's daunting, isn't it? The Poetry Out Loud competition is a recitation competition, and basically each student is told to take three poems and recite them. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so unique, is that you don't write the poem, you read the poem. And in reading the poem, you have to make the poem your own. So the thing about this competition is that each competitor is amazing, and it's kind of, I wouldn't want to have the job of being a judge, because they're just, the way they interpret poems, I would come across a poem that I read and I interpret it completely differently, and I'll see how someone else took it. And it's just an amazing experience, whether you're in the competition or you're an audience member. It's just, it's a great feeling as well.
Yeah, of course, that's one of the joys of poetry, is that two people can read it completely differently and, you know, you sort of refract it through a different lens each time. Yeah. Now, do you get to choose the poems? Do they give you a list you have to choose from? How does that work?
So the criteria is one poem has to be 25 lines or fewer, one has to be pre-20th century, and one has to be a poem of your choice. And I personally, you can combine the criteria. So I chose one poem that was both 25 lines or fewer and pre-20th century. And then
Which was that? What poem was it?
It was It Was Not Death Where I Stood Up by Emily Dickinson.
Emily Dickinson.
Yes. Uh-huh. And then my other two poems, which is Make a Law So That the Spine Remembers Wings by Larry Levis and Poem About People by Robert Pinsky.
And I understand that for the first time this year, they also had each of the contestants write a poem.
Yes. It's called the Poetry Ourselves Competition. So originally, the Poetry Out Loud Competition was only a recitation competition, and they incorporated writing your own poetry this year, which is something that I've been doing for a long time. And I kind of did it in the hustle of things. I didn't really plan on submitting a poem, but I had one just, you know, on my computer, and I was like, what's the harm in, you know, putting my foot forward? And so I did, and I'm grateful that I did, definitely. Yeah. And it's the first year that they did that.
And you have your phone with you and the poem's on the phone, so yeah. Could you read it for us? That's mm-hmm. great.
The Morrison House. The Morrison women had affixed themselves with the art of modern cooking. They folded themselves into the bread and polished the dishes until they bled. And their fingers were sore, and all of it for the art of modern cooking. The Morrison men had affixed themselves with the task of always eating. The Morrison woman's mouths in an insufferable drought. When the Morrison men eat again, always, always eating. The Morrison house had affixed himself with the job of always cleaning. The unspoken words of the Morrison wives and all of the secrets that they try to hide, sweeping up old wives' tales and polishing ugly truths when all else fails, to keep up the guise with the job of always cleaning. The walls in the house were not owned by the Morrisons. They had affixed themselves with the art of always watching, transfixed by a Thanksgiving dinner to die for. The turkey sits as the centerpiece, and for a moment, the Morrisons are still. But the walls have known the Morrison men since they were boys. How more often than not, stirring the pot kept the Morrison woman alive. For the Morrison house often had to clean up Morrison blood, and the Morrison men had eaten much more than just the food on their plate, and the Morrison women had learned to turn their food into their hate.
Cherise Achampong reading her wonderful poem, The Morrison House. That is captivating. It's terrific. It's beautifully written and beautifully read. And that's the thing about this competition. It's both, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just writing the poems, obviously. It's really just a sliver of it, but mm-hmm. it's performing a yeah. poem. How do you prepare? How did you practice?
Well, I think it's an understatement to say I always think about the poems that I'm reciting. I live and breathe the poems. I say them when I'm in the shower, when I'm washing the dishes. I'm just constantly reading them. The thing that's weird about recitation is that if you practice too much, it becomes mechanic and almost unrealistic. And so more so than reciting, I just make sure I know the poem in and out.
You don't want to act it as if you were in a scene in a movie
right.
or something.
You want it to be as genuine as when you first realize your own interpretation of it, because there's a very warm and promising feeling that comes along with the first interpretation or the first impression that you get when you read a poem compared to you diluting it after trying to recite it over and over again. So I think it's important to make sure the recitation is genuine and that you understand the poem and that not only that, but you relate the poem to yourself. Because mm-hmm. I think once you reach that point, it becomes more than just a poem. It becomes a part of you. And I think that's the part that really intrigued me about this competition.
Yeah. Your parents are Ghanaian and yes. you spent a year in Ghana, mm-hmm. Your freshman year in high school, and now you're a senior. How do you think that experience of living in Ghana informs your life as a poet and as a reciter of poems?
I think the biggest thing is that you realize that the human condition isn't specific to you. It's not an individual thing. When I went to Ghana, I thought it would be so different, so foreign. But the reality is that the kids there were just like me. They had parents just like mine. They went through experiences just like mine. And even though in some case that kind of scared me a little bit, I felt as though I was this small fly on a billiard piece, on this huge canvas that I couldn't navigate. But the reality is that it makes it that much more amazing to be able to interact with those people, finding that commonality between people. And I think Ghana definitely taught me that people aren't as different as you think they are, and that definitely translates into my poetry.
Well, Charisse Achampong, you are terrific. It's great to meet you. And break a leg on Monday. We're all going to be pulling for you.
Thank you so much.
Charisse Achampong is the Newtown High School senior and 2016 Maryland Poetry Out Loud champion. She'll be representing our state at the national finals on Monday in Washington. You can find out more about the Poetry Out Loud competition and see a video of Charisse reading her winning original poem on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Lauren Ferguson is our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. We hope you'll join us Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.